history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told, some valuable lessons waiting for us to learn, and sometimes all it takes is a little time. Time to ask a few questions, to listen, at times in amazement to circumstances and adventures that it can be hard for us to imagine. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And every time we do that, we end up learning and growing from it. We're educated, we're entertained, we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, which really can become even more powerful when there's somewhere you can go to see, to touch, to feel the history firsthand. Over the course of this next hour, we're going to talk about one of those opportunities, a traveling exhibit that is only heading to 10 cities around the country. It started out in Oregon's capital city last summer. If you're listening today on KYKN in Salem, maybe you got to visit the exhibit. I first got to experience it in Hawaii's capital city in November with some special touches illustrating the impact in Honolulu and Oahu. In the future, it'll be in Illinois, in Ohio, in Minnesota. If you're listening on KIV in Albuquerque, you'll be getting a New Mexico version of the exhibit sometime in 2019. If you're hearing us on KION in Monterey, California, it's coming your way in fall 2018. But between now and the first weekend in February, it's in a spot you probably wouldn't expect. And I really hope that those of you listening on stations in Fresno, in Bakersfield, in Modesto, San Luis Obispo, even those of you down in San Diego in that area, that you'll consider a trip to Kingsburg, California in the San Joaquin Valley to see the free, yes, I said free, exhibit called Communities of Compassion and Courage. We're going to hear from a few different voices today who put this powerful exhibit in perspective, and the topic is something that if you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, hopefully you've got a little background on. Some of the most powerful stories we've heard here have come from Nisei veterans of World War II, American-born soldiers of Japanese ancestry who fought for the very country that was detaining their families behind barbed wire. 120,000 Japanese Americans living on the West Coast were forced in the wake of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 into internment camps further inland. In many cases, they lost everything they had. In some inspiring examples, their families' possessions or land were held for them by kind-hearted neighbors who returned it to them after the war. We've heard from quite a few Nisei veterans over the years, including many from the legendary 442nd Regimental Combat Team. You've probably even heard it described as World War II's most decorated unit. Right after all Nisei veterans were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal in 2011, Bob Yano shared his story on Hometown Heroes. It's episode number 186 at hometownheroesradio.com if you want to hear that entire conversation. Mr. Yano is one of the veterans whose stories are presented as part of this traveling exhibit launched by the Go for Broke National Education Center. We're going to hear how Bob feels about this exhibit coming to his hometown in a bit, but inside of a case of his World War II memorabilia in Kingsburg is a very unique artifact that he described for us in his original appearance on Hometown Heroes. His mom had been visiting relatives in Hiroshima, Japan when the attack on Pearl Harbor happened. As the rest of his family headed to the Gila River internment camp in Arizona, he had no idea what had become of her. But before he left that camp to join the 442, he received a very special gift.
This is what you call in Japanese a sending buddy. Sending buddy means a thousand. Thousand dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you will survive the war and come back. So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here. So I had all these ladies put these dots on for you. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist. And it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. It reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now, and after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me. And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. She went around the whole camp. You can take 1,000 dot, that's a lot of women to put, each one put a dot. Mm-hmm. Although there was 6,000 people in there, but that still takes a lot of people to go around and get this dot.
That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way, way over and all the way back, up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever.
That special sash was with him then. It's on display now for you to go see in Kingsburg. If you've heard Bob's story, you know he never would see his mother again. She passed away in Japan during the war. We're going to hear from now nearly 94-year-old Bob Yano in a bit. But for now, let's learn more about this Communities of Compassion and Courage exhibit from its curator, Dave Meyer.
This is a project that has been a long time in the making. About 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, I received an email message because I have the media person for the Kingsburg Historical Society, and Gopher Broke had contacted us because they had heard that Bob Yano was the Grand Marshal at the Swedish Festival Parade, and they were interested in the fact that we had honored him here, and they seemed to think that there were other stories that might be found, and they were applying for a grant from the National Park Service to create this exhibition and to provide the exhibition to at least 10 cities around the country. And therefore, Kingsburg was considered a potential to be one of those 10 cities. We took the proposal to the board of directors of the Historical Society. They voted that they would be happy to be involved. And from there, we just kind of followed along step by step. We wrote a letter to support the grant application to the National Park Service. It sat kind of moribund for almost a year, and we actually forgot about it and just assumed that it had fallen by the wayside. And then one day I get an email that says, we have our grant, we're good to go, and you're one of the 10 cities that we want to feature in the exhibition. So for the last year, we have been working on, with Gopher Broke, having input into the overall exhibition, and then we've also been ferreting out the local stories, which are shown in the exhibition, primarily about 7 individual families and how they fared with the internment, but also featuring information about the community as a whole, as it was affected by the internment and by the war in general.
And I want to ask you about what you've learned in that process and what you hope people learn from coming to this exhibit. But just put your Kingsburg hat on for a second. And what does this mean for this community? Because I know that Kingsburg has an Olympic gold medalist in Rafer Johnson, you can claim, and his brother Jimmy Johnson in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I think you have the only Swedish coffee pot water tower in America. But to be one of only 10 cities in the country, what other people from the outside would say, little old Kingsburg, and you're one of 10 cities in the whole country that get this exhibit. How significant is that?
Well, I think it's huge for a number of different reasons. For one thing, we have brought in quite a few people from as far away as that I know of, San Diego to Northern California. They've come to Kingsburg, a community that they may never have known even existed. So that's impressive. And then these same people are coming to the Kingsburg Historical Park, which is, in my opinion, one of the least known little gems of Kingsburg. Very few people realize the depth and breadth of what our park has on site. And so it's given us a little bit of exposure for that. The next thing that would be really important would be that, just as I learned from my research, I'm hoping that we can transfer some of that information to the larger population about how important the Japanese Americans were to the early 20th century development of the San Joaquin Valley agriculture. I'm not sure that it's a story that is as well known as it should be. It certainly wasn't well known to me. And as I stated in the exhibit, in 1940, Kingsburg had 1,504 inhabitants, and we don't have any breakdown of the ethnicity. But we do know that it's generally accepted that in the early 1900s, Kingsburg was 90 or more percent Swedish. And so now we see this influx of Japanese Americans, most of whom were involved in agriculture because they came over not having language skills and not having any particular business or other commercial skills. So the avenues of economic activity open to them was pretty limited, and many, many of them became farm laborers and started out with the most humble beginnings, with no language skills and virtually no money. And in many cases, they were able to build upon that, save money, bring over brides from Japan, in some cases start up businesses, and in other cases buy some small farms and become fully integrated into the community until, of course, 1940.
Well, yeah, in just a few decades, they have all this momentum going. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and then Executive Order 9066, and now all of a sudden, they're not wanted here anymore. They're ostracized. And that's the bigger picture, but it sounds like, and in looking through your exhibit, you found not only the effects of that greater exclusion, but you saw some exceptions to that rule, where some compassion emerged from that landscape. What are the things that really surprised you or amazed you when you did that research?
That's a double-edged sword. It worked in two ways. I did ask people who were alive at the time if there was any protest to the 9066 coming out and taking all of these people away against their will. And from what I've been able to ascertain, there was very little in the way of protest. There may have been individual sentiments thinking that, gosh, this isn't the right thing to do, but there wasn't any much verbalization. That's the one side of it. The other side that we've emphasized quite a bit in telling some of the local stories is how these people were able to come back after the war and get back into whatever they had when they left, how the Mizutani's were able to get back into their market, and how the farmers such as the Setos and the Yanos and the Andos and Izakis were able to get back onto their farms. And it was mostly by the help of good citizens who either bought their land for a token amount, such as a dollar, and then resold it back to them when they returned for that same dollar, or who leased it, took care of the land, farmed it, or whatever, and then simply gave it back when the original owners returned.
Is there an element to this exhibit, piece of it? Because it is distinctly Kingsburg. This is a traveling exhibit. Some of the elements remain the same or similar, and I saw some of this in Honolulu at the debut of it there. But parts of it are distinctly Kingsburg. You mentioned the families whose stories are told there, and you get that context, and you see history, the history of Kingsburg, through this lens. Did you have any idea of how integral the Japanese-American community was to the history of this city?
No, I didn't.
And how long have you lived here?
I came to Kingsburg in 1977, although my wife is the third generation Kingsburg citizen, and I don't think she had any better clue than I did, having come here in 1977. The influences that used to exist is largely been hidden because the Japanese grocery stores are gone. The Buddhist church that existed prior to 1940 was burnt down during the war. It has been rebuilt in a different location. So there is that influence. But the population, I am pretty well convinced, has declined considerably. And I base that on the fact that if we go to our high school pictures and we look at the graduates of Kingsburg High, 1940, you will be at almost 20% of the graduating class was made up of Japanese American citizens. And then you go to 1943, say, after the Executive Order 9066 was out and after there had been time to remove everybody. And of course, there are no Japanese Americans left in that class. So if you proceed from that time forward into late 1940s, 1950s, you will see that the level of Japanese American students is never returned to that 20% mark. And that would indicate to me that we lost a part of that population that never returned to Kingsburg.
And this historical park has a whole bunch of different displays. You have an old elementary school, different buildings that represent different parts of Kingsburg's history. How far back does this go as far as the history that's depicted in the historical park?
It goes back to the early 1900s. The park has an amazing and extensive collection of everything from memorabilia to automobiles, trucks, horseless carriages. We have an early 1900s church that was in the country called Riverbend Church. That was moved in from the country in just the last year and completely refurbished to almost new condition as it would have been in the early 1900s. In fact, probably a little better than it was in the 1900s. We have an early 1900s house, which was also moved on site, and it's completely furnished with period furniture and museum quality mannequins that are dressed appropriately for the era. The kitchen is exactly what you would have found in early 1900s. It's an amazing display. It's of an accurate period of time. We just have tractors, and we have a Hall of Fame where we feature some of our famous residents, such as Rafer Johnson, Jimmy Johnson, Monty Clark, some of our veterans, and some of our maybe not known far and wide, but certainly known in Kingsburg for their contributions. We have a 1950s grocery store that has many of the authentic items that were actually in the grocery store when they closed it. That's a replication. And it just goes on and on and on. We even have some of the old Del Monte. Del Monte had a cannery here, closed about 5 years ago, I believe it was. We have some of their artifacts here that we display. And it's several acres of really a amazing amount of historical items.
So you're representing over 100 years of history. But it sounds like you're saying that until you took this project on, you didn't realize that you can't tell the history of Kingsburg without the contributions of the Japanese American community.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And we received some of the information from a fellow named Mance Ando. And Mance, in his later years, was a strawberry farmer. Believe it or not, when the first strawberries came in every year, the people would mob the place. And he'd have to put a sign out after they'd sell out very quickly because they come in slowly. And over a period of time when they're harvested, he was known far and wide for that. But he was also really helpful, and by the way, he has passed away. The interviews that we have of him are from earlier years, but he talked about the early agriculture, and he felt that the Japanese Americans were vital in terms of the development of San Joaquin Valley agriculture because they did a lot of the tree plantings. They did a lot of the early agriculture in terms of one thing that was very big was watermelons. At one time, watermelons were huge in this area, and the Japanese Americans were a large part of the producers of watermelons. And in fact, at one point, they even formed an organization because they felt they were not getting fair prices from the shippers. So they formed a coalition, which after World War II just fell apart, but they moved into other parts of agriculture. But he felt that they were an integral part of the agricultural development of the San Joaquin Valley in general and the Kingsburg area in specific.
So that's an example of some history, some broader history of the whole area that because of Pearl Harbor and 9066 was erased or forgotten. And would have been forgotten if not for projects like this that kind of scribble that back in and teach all of us and maybe add a little more perspective to how egregious it was to lock all these people up. And I don't want to put those words in your mouth. When you think about all the people that are going to come through here and see this in your hometown, what do you hope they get from it? What do you hope their takeaway is when they leave here?
I just like them to think about a number of things, one of which is, can something like this happen again? We've seen a lot of fear toward foreigners, toward refugees, toward people that are not like us. And this kind of gives you a basis for thinking about how these things can happen in a free country, a democracy. That to me is a big takeaway. Another thing that I would like especially youth, would take away from this is to examine how we talk about our history, how we look at our history. Many people would say, well, the internment camps or concentration camps, depending on what terminology you prefer to use, they were humane. We didn't torture people. We didn't starve people. We didn't beat people, so on and so forth. And they put that in reference to the brutalization that occurred in other theaters of war. The Japanese soldiers treated some of our soldiers brutally, then the German, all of these things happen in war, but they're not really comparable. You can't equate the two because these were, in many cases, American citizens that were supposed to have the protections of the U.S. Constitution, and those protections were just taken away with one executive order. And if you think about that, that's kind of a frightening thing that that can happen.
And this certainly highlights that. And I look over there at Bob Yano, almost 94 years old, using his cane, wearing his 442 hat, and looking at his memorabilia from the war in his hometown on this exhibit that so many people are going to see. Have you ever looked at him or someone like him, knowing what he went through, and said, boy, how would I have handled that if I were in that situation?
I thought of it many, many times, and I have to say that I would not have handled it as well. I would not have responded as positively as he did. I probably would have been angry and bitter, and I don't think that's would be the exception. I think Bob is the exception, and many of the people who were in the camps are the exception, because they have seemingly moved on and gotten over it. And if you think about it, especially the people that lost their farms, their businesses, or whatever in the war, they have a right to be angry about it, and yet they seem to have been able to go move on and get over that. And I admire that tremendously.
So that's a powerful example for the rest of us. And speaking of Bob, you have an exhibit here, an element to this display. That's all stuff of his uniform from the war, things he carried with him, including that hand-sewn wrap around his body that was meant for protection. Is there a part of his display that impresses you the most or that you get the most satisfaction out of?
Oh, yeah. The Sensibari, which is the sash you refer to, the story is absolutely fascinating about that. And I have to say, because it has such tremendous personal value to his family, we were kind of hesitant about putting it even in a locked cabinet in this display, because if something should happen to it, it would be irreplaceable. The concept was that in many times when these soldiers, and I believe this was done in Japan for Japanese soldiers as well as the tradition that was carried over by Japanese American soldiers here, when a soldier left to go to war, his mother would usually create this sash, and it would have 1,000 red dots sewn onto it. The object of that was that it would protect them in war. Bob, when he went to the Gila River camp, did not have a mother there. So the women in the camp made his sash for him, and he took that with him, and he wore it the entire time he was in Europe fighting the war. And to me, that's just an amazing, amazing artifact that he's generously loaned us to show. And I really wish people would understand the significance of something like that.
Well, they certainly will if they come out and see it in person here in Kingsburg. Before we take this break, Dave, maybe you can share those details for folks who are listening right now and say, yeah, I want to experience this free traveling exhibit.
Kingsburg Historical Park, and it will be open from Wednesday through Sunday from 9 o'clock until 5 o'clock each of those days. We'll be closed Monday and Tuesday. However, if we had a special tour that needed some special arrangements, we're certainly open to doing whatever we need to do to bring in the public.
Sounds like a good idea for teachers within a few hours' drive of Kingsburg. The Go for Broke National Education Center even has some classroom packets tailored to the exhibit. Again, it's in Kingsburg, California through February 4th, and I have that information linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, we'll hear how Nisei veteran Bob Yano feels about having this national tour stop in his hometown. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
They looked at me as though I was the enemy, and here I didn't do anything wrong. I was just a good citizen like anybody else. And yet, because our enemy was Japanese, even those of us who were in service were discharged. We were unwanted. Gosh, that was an awful feeling.
That's a short excerpt from dramatic audio that you'll hear emanating from a vintage radio as you walk through the latest stop on the Courage and Compassion Tour, a traveling exhibit produced by the Go for Broke National Education Center that is visiting 10 U.S. cities over a two-year period. From now until February 4th, it is in Kingsburg, California, at the Kingsburg Historical Park. Admission is free, and you'll have the chance to imagine yourself in the shoes of a Japanese American before, during, and after World War II. Bob Yano doesn't have to imagine, because he lived it. From being hauled away from his family's Kingsburg farm to the Gila River internment camp in Arizona, having his military status changed from eligible to serve to ineligible as an enemy alien to eligible again, he would go on to serve with the famous Go for Broke unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in Europe. He's a recipient of the Bronze Star and later was there in Washington, D.C. in 2011 when Nisei veterans were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal. But Bob's also been in countless classrooms in California and even as far away as Wisconsin, sharing his personal story and helping young people understand the broader story. He was doing that when I first had the privilege of meeting him all those years ago, and he's still doing it now. So the question is, why, Bob? Why is that so important to you?
Because I want people to know, you know. I'm sure there's a lot of people don't even know today what we had done, what 442 or the hundreds has done, you know. It's something that I've always believed in, that it's the only way is to get out and talk about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I try to do that even here. I've always done that here even. Recently I went to Sanger High School. It's a class that these kids have a problem with. It's not the regular class, but that didn't make no difference. Mm-hmm. I had a big turnout. I was surprised. I went to Clovis. One of my relatives, the teacher over there, asked me if I would come. I said, sure, I'll come. And I talked to a class in Clovis there, and I thought it was fantastic. A bunch of kids there, really, I was surprised, you know, maybe 100 kids there. Mm. And it was really interesting. I'd like that. I like to tell them what it is. And I had a wonderful class. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they did too.
Well, and I bet people are going to hear that and say, hey, well, I'm a teacher. I want them to come to my class. So you might get a few phone calls after this. And
yeah.
A lot of people are going to come through this exhibit in your hometown in Kingsburg. It's got a case of your memorabilia from the war. It also has a panel that tells the story of your family. And then it tells the bigger picture of a lot of Japanese-American families.
Yes, that's right.
And other families who helped them.
Right.
When you look at this exhibit, what jumps out to you? What do you see that says, boy, I'm really glad that's here, and I think that's going to have an impact?
I was here the other day even, and I was just watching people look. And I was impressed that just by their expression, you could just about tell if you look at something you don't like or you're not interested, you just glance and move on right away. But it seems like they just stand there and look at it, read and everything that's there. So that's what I observed, you know. Usually it's no different myself. When I go someplace and I'm interested, I stay there and look. But if I'm not interested, I just glance and move on, you know. So I think just by watching their expression, you can tell this group of people that I have observed here, I think they're interested. Yeah, I think they learned a little bit about it.
And there's only 10 cities in the whole country that are getting this exhibit. And Kingsburg is one of them. Little old Kingsburg in the middle of California is one of them.
Yeah.
And it's mostly because of you.
Is that right? I don't know. I guess I don't know, but I'm glad they brought it to Kingsburg. Yeah.
And I'm sure people are going to come from all around. You know, it's going to be in Monterey later, but, I mean, folks between here and there and all over California should be converging on Kingsburg to take a look at this. What do you want those people to understand when they come here and they walk through and they try to soak all of it in? What's the most important thing you want them to understand?
I don't think so much as thinking that how much we had to go through. It's just that we're part of Americans, you know. I want them to know we were good Americans. Mm-hmm. That's what I want them to know, you know, because after all, my parents, and I'm all the parents, I'm proud. I'm proud of them, yeah, because they're good Americans, imported Americans, you might say, but I could just even remember some of my dad's friends. And I can't, in my whole life here in Kingsburg, I can't recall any of the older people had done anything wrong that were outstanding that I could remember as a kid and growing up in this community. So I think that alone, to me, I'm proud. I'm proud of. And I want people to realize that they're all good Americans.
And I have to imagine that it's a little surreal to walk in here and you see photos from 70 years ago, 70 plus years ago, 75 years ago, when Executive Order 9066 came out. It's got to be surreal to look at those photos and you remember that you guys were the outcasts, that they wanted to erase you from Kingsburg. And now you come here today and the Americans of Japanese descent are celebrated. And this story is a showcase that Kingsburg is embracing and celebrating. I mean, are those two opposite sides of the coin or what?
I don't know. You know, a lot of people here, I remember, like, this grocery store. Mrs. Taney's is one of them. The oldest one is Mrs. Taney's. But there was always another one right across the street, Furuhashi's. And this is where my dad and them traded quite a bit. I remember that because this is where they'd get their groceries. My dad and them would associate with them more. They were just like any other hardworking people. And the only sad part of it is that I don't think they returned here after the war, you know. I think they settled in Oakland. But all in all, of all the members of Japanese American families or Japanese here, like the Andels has been here forever. Matt's Andel, he had a brother, but I could always remember the brother was younger than Matt's, but he always used to ride motorcycle with the Swedes, you know. And I even recall, I think my parents used to say, I wonder why he rides around with motorcycle with the white boys, you know. You know, Dad, you know, those days, not too much interracial thing, you know, friendship. But we had friendship, but not riding motorcycles like he was, you know, but I could still recall that him riding motorcycles. King. His nickname was King Andel.
Huh.
And I think they're all Harley Davidson motorcycles, but I could still remember because our neighbor was Westlands, and one of their boys was riding the motorcycle. So that all, you know, kind of falls in line. But I think King Andel was about the only Japanese American that rode a motorcycle, as far as I'm concerned. It always remains in my mind. Yeah.
If you think back to that whole time period, the attack on Pearl Harbor, 9066, the internment, serving in the 442, that whole period, what was the most difficult thing for you to face or endure?
I think probably the most thing that comes to my mind, even though I was in service, is how well we were going to be accepted when we come back. That's the number one issue, you know. How are they going to accept us? Are they still going to be like they were before, you know? It's a feeling that in my senior year coming to school, I still remember the first day I had some nice friends, you know, and just being cut off, you know, just shut off. So I can still remember that feeling today, even. Yeah.
Well, this has to be a much better feeling to come in here and see your story and stories like yours celebrated and honored and used as an example.
I think that's true, and I think I did my part, and all they have to do is look at it.
And there are a lot of elements to this exhibit. People could spend a lot of time here if they soak it all in.
Right, right.
And your story is there, and other veterans' stories are showcased.
Correct.
Is there an element of this exhibit, other than your memorabilia, which means a lot to you personally, is there another spot as you walk through here that really grabbed a hold of you, that kind of had the greatest impact on you?
Yeah, that man with the picking strawberries, Matt Sandel.
Yeah?
Yeah. I respect Matt Sandel.
You knew him?
Yeah. He's older than I, but he's a good man.
What was it about that element of the display that got you?
You look at the fellow that's standing right behind them, the pitcher, that's Dr. Larson. Now, Dr. Larson took care of me before I went to camp. I had pneumonia, and I was in a sanitarium here in Kingsburg for 30 days. There's another doctor that's I just never can forget, because he says, when you get in camp, write me a letter and let me know how you're doing. Now, I never forgot that. I did write a letter to him, thanking him for that.
Because that wasn't necessarily the easy thing for him to do, or what you'd expect out of him.
That's right. But he took care of me 30 days here in the sanitarium just before I went to the camp. And when I had pneumonia, I was laid up for, like I say, in that hospital. And I can still remember him punching my back with a needle to draw the fluid out of my lungs. And you can just about, I could feel it to this day, how it felt to go poof, you know, and you, like putting it in a balloon, you know. But he took care of me, and when I had to leave, that's what he told me, Dr. Larson. And that Larson's picture, it was where Matt Zander was in the back there. And that's one of the things that brought back the memory. But I never forgot that. And I did write. And he wrote a letter, short letter, asked how I was doing. And so I never forgot him. He's a wonderful doctor.
And I imagine something like that, and that photo that you're talking about is part of a bigger panel that also includes the other side of the coin. It includes a newspaper clipping about the time a Japanese school was burned down in Kingsburg.
Yeah.
You know, you have an example like that, and you see one side of it.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're saying your interaction with Dr. Larson and even seeing his photo there is a reminder to you of the things that gave you hope.
Yeah. I mean, if he was not a good person or whatever, you know, and they didn't say nothing or gave some kind of remark or what, I'd never forget it, you know. But this here is something that what doctor's going to tell you, write a letter and let him know how you're doing. And I never forgot that. I thought a word of Dr. Larson.
Was there anything else that I didn't ask you about that's on your mind as you consider this exhibit and all the people that are going to see it and the impact that it could have?
I'm just hoping that, you know, people will come and see and actually look, see. I hope so anyway.
Let me ask you this. It may not be easy. I don't even remember how many years it's been since we hung out the first time.
I knew you were coming, and I thought, wow, it's been a long time. Yeah. I never forgot that. No, I never forget that. Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if you've seen any change, because you've been telling your story and the story of the 442 for a long time. And it has been a few years since we talked the last time. Do you see a difference in people's understanding or awareness? Do you feel like your efforts and others who are telling that story, that there's an impact there? There's a difference being made?
Well, you know, since we first spoke, I think it's a little bit more widely known, you know. I think it is, after even when we spoke together the first time. It's come a long ways, I think. You have all these honor flights and, you know, all these things, and it's quite a thing, I think, yeah.
This exhibit will, I'm sure, take it to another level and reach even more people.
I'm sure it has, even to this day.
Are you going to be out here every once in a while as part of the living part of the exhibit so people can meet the man behind the photos and the memorabilia?
Well, if they want me here, I'll be here. You know.
How long are you going to keep doing this, going and talking to school kids and telling this story?
Well, I'm glad to do it. As long as they want me to talk, I'll talk. As long as I can talk, I'll talk.
How old are you now?
I'm 93. I'll be 94 in February, so get there.
I'm going to ask you this now. I don't want to brag, but when I saw you today, you gave me this pin. You took it off your hat. It's the emblem of the 442.
Right.
That torch against the hexagonal blue background.
Right.
And I'm honored that you would share this with me, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
My question to you is, what do you want me to think of when I look at this pin? What does it represent? What should I think of when I look at this?
First of all, I want you to think that when you see that, I want you to remember all of us Japanese Americans, what we had gone through, and, you know. And then the last part, just remember me, that's all. The last part. Because I always remember you, right? I never forget you. Yeah.
Well, I don't think anybody's going to forget you, especially if they come to this exhibit here at the Kingsburg Historical Park.
Yeah, but you impressed me from the day one, and I just never forgot you. I still remember you.
Well, right back at you, sir. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
I probably asked you this before, but maybe there's a different answer now. What are you most proud of?
Well, I think I'm most proud by serving America. You know, if I served and was a good American, I think probably would leave a good memory for everybody else. I did my part.
You did your part that hopefully no one else will have to go through what you went
through. That's right, right.
Well, thanks again, Bob. Great to see you again. And
thank you.
I hope a lot of people come out and chase you down out here, make you sign an autograph or two.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, we sure appreciate Bob Yano. That uniform he has on display in Kingsburg through February 4th, he still fits into it, believe it or not. And again, to hear Bob's war story, his close calls with the 442nd, and everything he experienced, pull up episode number 186 at hometownheroesradio.com. That's also where you can find more information about the Communities of Compassion and Courage exhibit. And we'll pull in one more perspective on that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode devoted to the traveling exhibit called Courage and Compassion, helping the rest of us understand the experience of Japanese Americans during World War II. One of the perks, if you visit the exhibit in Kingsburg, California through February 4th, or at future stops in places like Chicago, Minneapolis, Albuquerque, or Monterey, is that you can also pick up free family passes for the Go for Broke National Education Center's permanent display in the Los Angeles area. We've heard about this Kingsburg version of the exhibit from its curator, as well as a Nisei veteran whose story is included. But some of the more powerful elements of this display are interactive. You can follow along yourself on computer screens and have to make decisions that Japanese Americans were faced with in the wake of Executive Order 9066. You can write down examples of courage that you've witnessed that run parallel to some of the stories that you'll learn about. And I guess I shouldn't tell you everything, because it's going to be better if you experience it yourself. Dale Ikeda has done that. He's also done as much as just about anybody I know in the Central California area to honor the sacrifices of Japanese Americans during World War II, to make sure their story of perseverance in the face of injustice is preserved as both an inspiring and cautionary tale. And I think Dale's perspective is a valuable one for us to obtain with respect to this traveling exhibit and the fact that one of just 10 cities in the whole U.S. to host it is Kingsburg, California, with a population of just under 12,000 people.
I think it's a great honor and a feather in the cap of the Kingsburg community. The exhibit is being sponsored by the Kingsburg Historical Society. Dave Meyer has been the laboring oar and all that. I was called in as a member of the Japanese American community to provide input, and it was our honor to have the Japanese American Citizens League and the Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 8499 co-sponsor a nice reception to kick off the event. For me personally, it's a continuation of an educational process, and it's also a way to honor the Nisei, that second generation, as well as the Issei, the first generation of Japanese Americans who immigrated here. Because of them, I attribute my success in life. I became an attorney, became a judge, and I wonder if I could have achieved my personal success without the efforts of those who came before me, in particular the Nisei veterans, the Japanese American veterans of World War II, who fought in Europe and the Pacific in a way as a Sansei, third-generation Japanese-American. The exhibit honors our parents and grandparents for their courage, their perseverance and sacrifice in the face of adversity. As an American, I think it's a wonderful story, not just a Japanese-American story, but an American story of a community faced with adversity. A lot of communities have faced that as they immigrated to America and overcame hardship. They sought the American dream. For Japanese-Americans, it became a nightmare during World War II, but ultimately through perseverance and sacrifice, hard work and effort, Japanese-Americans have gain rights as full citizens in this country, and we have wonderful examples of those icons of the community achieving the American dream, whether it's Senator Daniel Inouye or Secretary Norman Mineta or General Eric Shinseki or others. So it's great that this has come to a small community like Kingsburg, and it's an opportunity to tell the stories of folks from Central California who contributed. Over 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry were forcibly removed from their homes, their farms, their schools, their jobs, their occupations, and in turn for nearly 3 years against their will, basically prisoners of war in a sense by their own government. And yet Nisei volunteered to fight in Europe and in the Pacific and did so with distinction. So it's great to tell that story. What I like about the Kingsburg exhibit is it also tells the story of the neighbors and friends who took care of farms, took care of property, and greeted their neighbors back with open arms and returned that property to them so that Japanese Americans could continue on with their lives afterward.
It's powerful to see those stories, and you see these little slivers that reflect a bigger picture, and you said something, that it's not just a Japanese-American story, that it's an American story. And I get the sense, as I walk around this exhibit with you a little bit, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like what you're most enthused about with this being here is what it can do for the future. Not necessarily chronicling the past, but that it could have an impact on our future. Am I getting that right? And if so, what are you hoping comes out of this?
Well, first, let's start with the basics. Those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And so we don't want this repeated on any Americans, whether they're Muslim or from Arab country or otherwise. We certainly have issues today that bear upon some of the same questions of loyalty and segregating out a community to be treated unfairly. It also, I think, in a broader sense, is an inspirational story, not just about what the Japanese Americans did, but what the neighbors have done. Those who helped the Japanese Americans during the war took a risk because in some communities they were called Jap lovers, were themselves discriminated against and treated unfairly. But I think it tells a story that in times of crisis, we see the best and worst in people. And that's certainly true here. On the one hand, there was hatred, there was discrimination in the worst way. Yet despite that, there are these stories of individuals who did the right thing and helped their neighbors and friends and stood for the principles that America stands for, which is equal treatment, due process of law, fairness, justice. So it tells an important story that can inspire us into the future so that when we have to make some difficult choices, we do the right thing.
Well said. And you mentioned that your career has been in the legal profession. With that perspective, do you ever look at any of this information, read about the history, or hear the stories from the Nisei and say, how did they get away with that? How could a country with these laws allow those things to happen?
I ask myself that same question from at least seventh grade. And in high school, I had started taking an interest in the story and finding out more. That's really what got me interested in history and law. I went to Stanford University, studied history, did research on the American Friends Services Committee that helped the Japanese Americans during World War II, went to law school at King Hall School of Law at UC Davis, read about the Korematsu case and a little footnote on the Urabayashi and Yasui cases that dealt with the exclusion of Japanese Americans and also with the issue of curfews, and there were also travel restrictions. When I had the opportunity to work on a memorial at the fairgrounds, we dedicated that memorial in 1992, the 50th anniversary of the executive order, and it was a privilege and honor to work on the other memorials.
And there's just an example right there where something that was so unfortunate and so devastating became the seed for great things in the future, for motivating you. And I know you see some of those silver linings throughout this. But as you walk around the exhibit, are there certain elements of it that even for you who've been marinating in this for most of your life, that it grabs you, that it's powerful, that you think it tells a story that people will really identify with and learn from?
There's an interactive section. Most people will be reluctant to spend the time going through the station, but it's very telling. It not only teaches the history, but puts the reader in the position of somebody having to face difficult decisions. How would they respond to questions 27 and 28 if they were asked, would you forswear allegiance to the country that your forefathers came from, and will you fight for the U.S. without restriction or qualification if called to do so, without any explanation as to what the consequences were? The case of Japanese Americans, if they answered no or no, no, then they were sent to Tule Lake, a segregated high-security concentration camp.
So what would you have answered, Dale?
That's a good question. I would like to think that I would have answered yes, yes. I would like to think that when given the opportunity, I would have volunteered to serve in the U.S. military service. But it's hard to say because that's looking backwards. And how would you feel if you're given only 6 days' notice to settle your affairs, go to the Fresno Fairgrounds, which had been turned into a concentration camp with military-like barracks hastily built, being there, not even in some cases being able to take in baseball equipment, a bat, because it might be used as a weapon, and then asked to answer these questions. It'd be difficult.
No doubt. And you probably get sick of me mentioning it, but I can never see you without thinking of your Uncle Fumio as one of the first Nisei veterans I ever interviewed over a decade ago. He served in the military intelligence service. There's another story in this exhibit of someone from the Selma-Kingsburg area who also was in the MIS, but ended up with a real unique role, not just in the war, but in the post-war period. What can you tell me about Khan Tagami and his unique legacy that's celebrated here in this exhibit?
Lieutenant Khan Tagami was born in Selma. His family had ties to Kingsburg. We have records that at least some of his family members attended Kingsburg High School because their names are in the yearbook. He was in the military intelligence service. I believe he was with Merrill's Marauders at one time, which was a famous unit that would make attacks in the India-Burma area. Anyway, the important part for me has to do with his assignment after America defeated Japan, and he was the personal interpreter to General Douglas MacArthur, the commander of the occupational forces. But more importantly, he served as a liaison to the emperor. On one occasion, General MacArthur asked him to deliver a message to the emperor that the Western media would seek interviews, and it was up to him whether or not he wanted to take part in those interviews. So Lieutenant Tagami was permitted to meet with the emperor, and in a rare one-on-one session, the only one that I'm aware of with the emperor and somebody from the West, he delivered the message. And as he was getting ready to leave, the emperor said, "Lieutenant Tagami, I want to thank you and the other Nisei veterans for acting as a bridge between our two countries." And I think it's such a great story because it tells us that the Nisei veterans not only helped to win the war in Europe and in the Pacific, but it also helped establish a lasting peace between the U.S. and Japan that exists today. Part of that legacy is related, if I may go into that. Khan's son, John Tagami, worked in Congress as an aide. Two of the projects he worked on related to the Nisei veterans. One was to have Congress pass special legislation recognizing the Military Intelligence Service and awarding it the Presidential Unit Citation, which was difficult because the Military Intelligence Service was used to provide interpreters, translators, and interrogators to different units in the Pacific. So they weren't an identifiable segregated unit, so it required special legislation. He managed to do that. There were 7 Presidential Unit Citations for the 442nd. And 1 Presidential Unit Citation for the MIS. And then he also helped with the legislation to upgrade 20 recipients of the Distinguished Service Cross to Medals of Honor. That included Senator Dan Inouye's Medal of Honor. He lost his arm fighting in Italy and was Attorney General in Hawaii after the war. Became Hawaii's first congressman after it became a state, and later its first senator.
And that happened in the 1990s, and the implication, of course, was what all of those young men did was worthy of the Medal of Honor, but they had been denied for one reason or another, and in many cases the reason was probably because they were Japanese American.
Exactly. Only 1 Medal of Honor was awarded during the war. The time, the statute of limitations for conferring the Medal of Honor had long passed. So it took, as you say, 50 years to accomplish that.
And the son of someone who had been so involved at the end of the war. And when you told the story of Khan Tagami, I'm just imagining, what are the odds of that? That a young man whose family is held prisoner is over there halfway across the world brokering a resolution, or at least in the aftermath, figuring out how to proceed with the Emperor of Japan. And who else could have done that in that moment? But what are the odds that someone could come from that situation here as an outcast to that position of such great importance?
Khan Tagami had actually studied in Japan. He was what we call Kibei, born in America, studied in Japan, and then returned to America. And I had heard a story, probably from John Tagami, the son, that the emperor was in a train going through a village where Khan was living, going to school, and all of the students were to bow down when the train was to pass the town, not to look up because the emperor was a sun god and they might be blinded, and to honor the emperor as he passed. So that is an interesting story, to go from that to having a one-on-one audience with the emperor.
Anything else that you want to mention about the exhibit, feel free, but to see Bob Yano out here, almost 94 years old, and has all his memorabilia here, and you can see on his face what it means to him to have this here in Kingsburg. How satisfying is that for you, that this is happening while someone like he is still here to be a part of it?
I think it's wonderful. We have a great country, a country built upon wonderful values, some of which appear in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with their creator with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of justice. When people can see that we're not a perfect country, that we were formed in order to form a more perfect union, it's really a striving, and there have been so many things that have helped ameliorate some of the harm. And to have him, and we had a reception, he had probably 20 family members here, to honor him and his generation and the veterans for all that they've done for all of us is very gratifying to me. I'd like to mention one other legacy story. Shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Japanese American men who were not already in service reclassified 4C, enemy alien ineligible for the draft. And so these second generation firstborn Nisei, who were citizens, are now being classified enemy alien. Of course, at some point, the 100th Battalion was created out of the Hawaii. They wanted 3,000 volunteers. They got 10,000 who applied, and over 3,500 served initially. And then the 442nd was created and established this wonderful war record, often described as the most decorated unit in American military history for its size and length of service. And then one generation later, Eric Shinseki, the son of one of those reclassified as 4C, became chief of staff of the Army, the highest office in the Army. And it's also inspiring to me that he was nominated to be Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki was, on Pearl Harbor Day. For me, December 7th was always a day of anxiety growing up. Didn't necessarily want to be outside. There were stories of the people shooting into the JCL office in West Fresno. A lady was hit unprovoked as she was in her car, and the only thing we could figure was it was December 7th and she was Japanese American. And then to have Eric Shinseki nominated on Pearl Harbor Day, that made us all very proud.
It's amazing what can happen over time. And speaking of time, I hope you'll take some time while there is still time. Kingsburg is accessible from just about anywhere in California. It's right smack dab in the middle of the state. Go experience this powerful exhibit between now and February 4th. For those of you listening in other states, it might be coming your way too. I have that list of future stops linked at hometownheroesradio.com, where of course you can also find quite a few episodes in which Japanese American veterans tell their personal World War II stories. Thanks to Dale Ikeda, Dave Meyer, and the one and only Bob Yano for their time and perspective. And thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.